Chapter 63. Unfortunate renown. It causes much comment, I believe, but that is not an overstatement. Some of this comment is palliative, but some of it by patrons at a distance, who only know the statistics without the explanation, is offensive, and in some cases even violent. 9 students have been called home. The trustees of the college have been growing more and more uneasy all these last months, steadily along with the implacable increase in your census, and I will not conceal from you that more than once they have touched upon the expediency of a change in the professorship of moral culture. The coarsely sarcastic editorial in yesterday's Alta, headed "Give the Moral Acrobat a Rest," has brought things to a crisis, and I am charged with the unpleasant duty of receiving your resignation. I know you only mean me a kindness, dear 1365, but it is a most deadly mistake. Please do not name your engine for me. Truly yours. Mailed answer. New York, September 8, 1887. Dear sir, necessarily I cannot assent to so strange a proposition. And I think it but fair to warn you that, if you put the piece on the stage, you must take the legal consequences. Yours respectfully, S50. Clemens. Before the days of international copyright, no American author's books were pirated more freely by Canadian publishers than those of Mark Twain. It was always a sore point with him that these books, cheaply printed, found their way into the United States, and were sold in competition with his better editions. The law on the subject seemed to be rather hazy, and its various interpretations exasperating. In the next unmailed letter, Mark Twain relieves himself to a misguided official. The letter is worth reading today, if for no other reason, to show the absurdity of copyright conditions which prevailed at that time. Unmailed letter to H100. Christiancy, on book piracy. Hartford, December 18, 87. H100. Christiancy, Esq. Dear sir, as I understand it, the position of the U.S. government is this. If a person be captured on the border with counterfeit bonds in his hands, bonds of the NY Central Railway, for instance, the procedure in his case shall be as follows. 1. If the NY 100 have not previously filed in the several police offices along the border proof of ownership of the originals of the bonds, the government officials must collect a duty on the counterfeits, and then let them go ahead and circulate in this country. 2. But if there is proof already on file, then the NY 100 may pay the duty and take the counterfeits. But in no case will the United States consent to go without its share of the swag. It is delicious. The biggest and proudest government on earth turned sneak thief, collecting pennies on stolen property, and pocketing them with a greasy and libidinous leer, going into partnership with foreign thieves to rob its own children, and when the child escapes the foreigner, descending to the abysmal baseness of hanging on and robbing the infant all alone by itself. Dear sir, this is not any more respectable than for a father to collect toll on the forced prostitution of his own daughter. In fact, it is the same thing. Upon these terms, what is a U.S. custom house but a fence? That is all it is. A legalized trader in stolen goods. And this nasty law, this filthy law, this unspeakable law calls itself a regulation for the protection of owners of copyright. Can sarcasm go further than that? In what way does it protect them? Inspiration itself could not furnish a rational answer to that question. Whom does it protect, then? Nobody, as far as I can see, but the foreign thief dash sometimes and his fellow footpad the U.S. government, all the time. What could the Central Company do with the counterfeit bonds after it had bought them of the Star-Spangled Banner Master Thief? Sell them at a dollar apiece and fetch down the market for the genuine $100 bond? What could I do with that 20-cent copy of Owing It, which the United States has collared on the border and is waiting to release to me for cash in case I am willing to come down to its moral level and help rob myself? Sell it at 10 or 15 cents duty added and destroy the market for the original $3.50 book. Whoever did invent that law? I would like to know the name of that immortal jackass. Dear sir, I appreciate your courtesy in stretching your authority in the desire to do me a kindness, and I sincerely thank you for it. But I have no use for that book, and if I were even starving for it, I would not pay duty on it either, to get it or suppress it. No doubt there are ways in which I might consent to go into partnership with thieves and fences, but this is not one of them. This one revolts the remains of my self-respect, turns my stomach. I think I could companion with a highwayman who carried a shotgun and took many risks. Yes, I think I should like that if I were younger, but to go in with a big rich government that robs paupers and the widows and orphans of paupers and takes no risk, why, the thought just gags me. Oh, no, I shall never pay any duties on pirated books of mine. I am much too respectable for that yet a while. But here one thing that grovels me is this. As far as I can discover, while freely granting that the U.S. copyright laws are far and away the most idiotic that exist anywhere on the face of the earth, they don't authorize the government to admit pirated books into this country, toll or no toll. And so I think that that regulation is the invention of one of those people, as a rule, early stricken of God, intellectually the departmental interpreters of the laws in Washington. They can always be depended on to take any reasonably good law and interpret the common sense all out of it. They can be depended on, every time, to defeat a good law and make it inoperative, yes, and utterly grotesque too, mere matter for laughter and derision. Take some of the decisions of the Post Office Department, for instance, though I do not mean to suggest that that asylum is any worse than the others for the breeding and nourishing of incredible lunatics. I merely instance it because it happens to be the first to come into my mind. Take that case of a few years ago where the P.M. General suddenly issued an edict requiring you to add the name of the state after Boston, New York, Chicago, and C in your superscriptions, on pain of having your letter stopped and forwarded to the dead letter office. Yes, and I believe he required the county to. He made one little concession in favor of New York. You could say New York City and stop there, but if you left off the ID, you must add .y. to your New York. Why, it threw the business of the whole country into chaos, and brought commerce almost to a standstill. Now think of that. When that man goes to, well, wherever he is going to, we shan't want the microscopic details of his address. I guess we can find him. Well, as I was saying, I believe that this whole paltry and ridiculous swindle is a pure creation of one of those cabbages that used to be at the head of one of those retreats down there, departments, you know, and that you will find it so, if you will look into it. And moreover, but land, I reckon we are both tired by this time. Truly yours, Mark Twain. XXVII, Miscellaneous Letters of 1887. Literary articles. Peaceful Days at the Farm. Favorite reading. Apology to Mrs. Cleveland, etc. We have seen in the preceding chapter how unknown aspirants in one field or another were always seeking to benefit by Mark Twain's reputation. Once he remarked, the symbol of the human race ought to be an axe. Every human being has one concealed about him somewhere. He declared when a stranger called on him, or wrote to him, in 9 cases out of 10 he could distinguish the gleam of the axe almost immediately. The following letter is closely related to those of the foregoing chapter, only that this one was mailed not once, but many times, in some form adapted to the specific applicant. It does not matter to whom it was originally written, the name would not be recognized. To Mrs. T. Concerning Unearned Credentials, etc., Hartford, 1887. My dear madam, it is an idea which many people have had, but it is of no value. I have seen it tried out many and many a time. I have seen a lady lecturer urged and urged upon the public in a lavishly complimentary document signed by Longfellow, Whittier, Holmes and some others of supreme celebrity, but there was nothing in her and she failed. If there had been any great merit in her, she never would have needed those men's help, and, at a rather mature age, would never have consented to ask for it. There is an unwritten law about human successes, and your sister must bow to that law, she must submit to its requirements. In brief, this law is 1. No occupation without an apprenticeship. 2. No pay to the apprentice. This law stands right in the way of the subaltern who wants to be a general before he has smelt powder, and it stands, and should stand, in everybody's way who applies for pay or position before he has served his apprenticeship and proved himself. Your sister's course is perfectly plain. Let her enclose this letter to Major J. B. Pond, and offer to lecture a year for $10 a week and her expenses, the contract to be annullable by him at any time, after a month's notice, but not annullable by her at all. The second year, he to have her services, if he wants them, at a trifle under the best price, offered her by anybody else. She can learn her trade in those 2 years, and then be entitled to a remuneration, but she cannot learn it in any less time than that, unless she is a human miracle. Try it, and do not be afraid. It is the fair and right thing. If she wins, she will win squarely and righteously, and never have to blush. Truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. Howells wrote, in February, offering to get a publisher, to take the library of humor off Mark Twain's hands. Howells had been paid $2,600 for the work on it, and his conscience hurt him when he reflected that the book might never be used. In this letter he also refers to one of the disastrous inventions in which Clemens had invested, a method of casting brass dies for stamping book covers and wallpaper. Howells' purpose was to introduce something of the matter into his next story. Mark Twain's reply gives us a light on this particular invention. Hartford, February 15, 87. Dear Howells, I was in New York 5 days ago, and Webster mentioned the library, and proposed to publish it a year, or a year and a half hence. I have written him your proposition today. The library is part of the property of the 150 W. and Company firm. I don't remember what that technical phrase was, but I think you will find it in an encyclopedia under the head of brass. The thing I best remember is that the self-styled inventor had a very ingenious way of keeping me from seeing him apply his invention. The first appointment was spoiled by his burning down the man's shop in which it was to be done, the night before. The second was spoiled by his burning down his own shop the night before. He unquestionably did both of these things. He really had no invention. The whole project was a blackmailing swindle, and cost me several $1,000s. The slip you sent me from the May Tutti has delighted Mrs. Clemens and me to the marrow. To think that thing might be possible to many, but to be brave enough to say it is possible to you only, I certainly believe. The longer I live, the clearer I perceive how unmatchable, how unapproachable, a compliment one pays when he says of a man he has the courage to utter his convictions. Haven't you had reviewers talk Alps to you, and then print Potato Hills? I haven't as good an opinion of my work as you hold of it, but I've always done what I could to secure and enlarge my good opinion of it. I've always said to myself, everybody reads it, and that's something that surely isn't pernicious, or the most acceptable people would get pretty tired of it. And when a critic said by implication that it wasn't high and fine, through the remark, "High and fine literature is wine," I retorted, confidentially, to myself, "S. High and fine literature is wine, and mine is only water, but everybody likes water." You didn't tell me to return that proof slip, so I have pasted it into my private scrapbook. None will see it there. With a thousand thanks. Is ever Mark. Our next letter is an unmailed answer, but it does not belong with the others, having been withheld for reasons of quite a different sort. Johnette Gilder, then of The Critic, was one of Mark Twain's valued friends. In the comment which he made, when it was shown to him 22 years later, he tells us why he thinks this letter was not sent. The name, Rest and Be Thankful, was the official title given to the summer place at Elmira, but it was more often known as Oury Farm. To Johnette Gilder, not mailed, : Hartford, May 14, 87. My dear Miss Gilder, we shall spend the summer at the same old place, the remote farm called Est and Be Thankful, on top of the hills 3 miles from Elmira, and why your other question is harder to answer. It is my habit to keep 4 or 5 books in process of erection all the time, and every summer add a few courses of bricks to 2 or 3 of them, but I cannot forecast which of the 2 or 3 it is going to be. It takes 7 years to complete a book by this method, but still it is a good method. Gives the public a rest. I have been accused of ushing into print prematurely, moved thereto by greediness for money, but in truth I have never done that. Do you care for trifles of information? Well then, Tom Sawyer and The Prince and the Pauper were each on the stocks 2 or 3 years, and LD Times on the Mississippi 8. One of my unfinished books has been on the stocks 16 years, another 17. This latter book could have been finished in a day, at any time during the past 5 years. But as in the first of these two narratives all the action takes place in Noah's Ark, and as in the other the action takes place in heaven, there seemed to be no hurry, and so I have not hurried. Tales of stirring adventure in those localities do not need to be rushed to publication lest they get stale by waiting. In 21 years, with all my time at my free disposal I have written and completed only 11 books, whereas with half the labor that a journalist does I could have written 60 in that time. I do not greatly mind being accused of a proclivity for rushing into print, but at the same time I don't believe that the charge is really well founded. Suppose I did write 11 books, have you nothing to be grateful for? Go to - remember the 49 which I didn't write. Truly yours S50. Clemens. Notes added 22 years later, : Stormfield, April 30th, 1909. It seems the letter was not sent. I probably feared she might print it, and I couldn't find a way to say so without running a risk of hurting her. No one would hurt Johnette Gilder purposely, and no one would want to run the risk of doing it unintentionally. She is my neighbor, 6 miles away now, and I must ask her about this ancient letter. I note with pride and pleasure that I told no untruths in my unsent answer. I still have the habit of keeping unfinished books lying around years and years, waiting. I have 4 or 5 novels on hand at present in a half-finished condition, and it is more than 3 years since I have looked at any of them. I have no intention of finishing them. I could complete all of them in less than a year, if the impulse should. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.